Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is New York Times number one best-selling author David Ellis. Now, David is a judge and an Edgar Award-winning author of 10 novels of crime fiction, as well as 8 best-selling books co-authored with James Patterson. And I have a feeling I've listened to some of your work with James on Audible. His novels have been translated into more than 10 languages worldwide. In December 2014, Day was sworn in as the youngest serving justice of the Illinois Appellate Court for the First District. He lives outside Chicago with his wife and 3 children. Welcome to Writers' Voices, David.
Thanks for having me, Monica. It's great to be here.
Is it as hot in Chicago today as it is here, over here across the river in Iowa?
It's getting up towards 90, I think.
So, and humid and sticky and all those things. Yeah.
Always humid in Chicago. We're going to be welcoming the Democratic National Convention next week with a lot of hot heat and humidity. But...
A lot of sweaty people.
Yes.
Well, The Best Lies is the book we're talking about today. So this must be your 10th. Is this your 10th?
I believe if we're talking about my solo books, this will be number 11.
Number 11.
Yeah.
Okay, so
yeah,
you'll need to update your bio on your webpage. So when did you start writing crime fiction?
So I mean, the truth, Monica, is I was a writer before I was probably anything else. I was a writer when I was a child, and I would write. Do you remember the old Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew mysteries?
Of course, I do.
Sure, right? So when I was a kid, those were the books you read. You know, my sister read Nancy Drew, and then I read them, and I read Hardy Boys. And I wrote a few books about two brothers, much like the Hardy Boy brothers. And, mysteries that were maybe 30 pages long, but that was a long thing to write when you're, like, in second and third grade.
Wow.
And, the funny thing is, you know, throughout, you know, elementary school, you get a lot of creative writing opportunities. And I would do some of my own, like I just said, just on the side. But as you get older in education, and I only mean like middle school and then high school even, those opportunities tend to dry up. The curriculum tends to de-emphasize creative writing. You still take English, but you don't take creative writing. And the older I got, the more my priorities were changing. And, you know, by high school, I cared about 3 things. I wanted to get really good grades. I wanted to meet as many girls as I could. And I was really into sports. And so in terms of getting good grades, I did the work assigned to me and tried to do it well. But I was not going out and searching out my own creative writing opportunities. It sort of fell by the wayside without me even realizing it. And I wasn't being assigned it. And so, you know, then fast forward, I go to college, get a finance degree. I go to law school, and law school, you know, I worked through most of law school as well as going to law school. So you have no free time. And the next thing I know, Monica, I've been a lawyer for 2 years working these ungodly hours at a big Chicago law firm. And I'm on vacation in Florida. We've all had these moments, right? I'm on vacation. My toes are in the sand. I'm having a cocktail, maybe a slight buzz, right? Watching the sun go down and thinking about my life a little bit, getting philosophical. And again, I'd been a lawyer for just a couple of years. I was just a young professional. And I thought to myself, hey, whatever happened to that thing you loved to do? I still loved reading. I loved reading suspense novels, thrillers, you know, murder mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why did you stop writing? And I didn't have a good reason. I had a reason. It wasn't that good. It's nobody was making me do it anymore. And so one of the reasons I'd like to tell that story to people is that to your children, to your grandchildren, to you yourself, if you're somebody of that age, of the school age, the curriculum in these schools may not be emphasizing creative writing. If your child, grandchild, friend, you know, has a knack for it, has a desire for it, you may have to bring it out of them yourself. I have a daughter who's now starting high school who likes to write creatively like her dad, but doesn't get assigned it very much. And so we sometimes do some things together. Like You have to search it out. But when people say, how'd you become a writer? I'd say, well, I was a writer before I was a lawyer. I was a writer my whole life. I just forgot about it for about 20 years.
I never really thought about that, about how you're right. The creative writing definitely takes a back seat in our educational process at a certain point.
And you know, that's funny because the other arts don't. I mean, you want to play, my daughter plays violin. She played it all through school. Flute, piano, most of these things, maybe not piano, but a lot of these musical instruments and choir and acting, musical theater, those things are taught, but people don't ask you to write creatively. And so and it's so important. It's so good for your brain to write creatively. So good of an outlet for you psychologically. There's so many good things for that come from it, besides just enjoying the craft of writing. And I wish that we could go back to making that more of an emphasis.
Especially now, because a lot of the other things, to be honest, that we learn how to do, we don't actually need to know anymore because computers can do it all for us.
I agree.
But creative, true creative writing, yeah, there are AI stories out there, but they aren't very good.
Right.
And I think there's probably going to be more and more future career-wise in creative endeavors as more mundane skills get replaced by computers.
I think that is as true as it's ever been today. I heard the other day, I was watching something where Neil deGrasse Tyson was talking about why you learn math. And he said, you always hear kids say, I'm not going to need to know the Pythagorean theorem when I'm, even if I go into like accountants or number-based jobs, I won't need to know that. I won't need to multiply 14 times 17 because I'm going to have a calculator. And he said, the benefits of learning those things are not that you remember those things necessarily, but the sparks in your brain, the muscles you work in your brain that allow you to be more adaptive as you get older to other things. And I think that, and I was listening to that and I was thinking, Monica, like, that's exactly how I feel about creative writing. Like, more than ever, you said it best. I mean, more than ever, we are going to need people to think out of the box in the future and to be creative. The more mundane things will be replaced. They already have been replaced by a lot of robotics and machinery, but AI is going to come even more into play in ways that probably you and I don't even understand. But so I, using that side of your brain creatively is so important, and I worry that we don't do it enough.
And I wonder how many adults are walking around today who loved writing when they were kids and then haven't, didn't have that moment in the sand that you had, the moment on the beach where you realized, hey, I need to get back to that. And what a
I think
loss.
I agree, and I'll read. I'm always getting inquiries from people who want to get published, and they'll say, "Can you read my manuscript? Give me, and some of these manuscripts I read, I'm like, you're a better writer than I am. I mean, you're great, but you're going to have a hard time breaking in, and you need some luck, and you need a lot of things to happen. There are a lot of really talented writers out there. There's a, you know, I always say there's a million reasons not to write a book, Monica. And the thing I am proudest of is that I decided to pursue that. I had that dream, and I kind of rediscovered it on that beach. I really did. And then I said, you're not just going to talk about this, Dave. I mean, I had a demanding job. I would be at work sometimes till 10 p.m. at night. I'd work, 14-hour days, but I would reserve an hour a night to write. And I had to have discipline to do that. And I saw it through. And I knew the odds of my succeeding in getting a book published, if that's what you mean by success, and most people do. I knew those odds were against me. But I said, you're not going to know unless you try. And most people will give up. And you, Dave, will not give up. And I didn't. And I got rejected. My first novel, I think, got rejected. I don't think, I know my first novel got rejected by about 75 literary agents. And
Whoa.
that book ended up winning the Edgar Allan Poe Award for best first novel. But I listened to some of the critiques I got from these agents, but most of them just said no in a very curt, no, thank you. But I believed in myself and I kept making the book better. And, and I guess the rest is history. But, I hope my books are good. I think they are. And I'm having success is great. But what I'm proudest of, and always will be proudest of, is that I didn't give up. And because every one of those nights over 3 years that I wrote that first novel, I had plenty of reasons not to spend that hour writing. I could say, well, it's just 1 hour, whatever, I'll make it up tomorrow. Or, going out with the buddies for a drink after work, or, whatever, I was athletic, I used to work out a lot, I could be lifting weights or running, I could be watching TV or sleeping, but instead I gave at least 1 hour every night as a matter of discipline. And every one of those hours I could have not done, and I had reason to not do it. You have to make it some priority if you're going to be able to do it.
Absolutely. And of course, you're right. The odds are against you, and in terms of publication being published, especially now, because despite the fact that there's probably a lot of people who have given up who would love to write, there are a lot of people writing books today, way more than ever in history. I think I read that 2 million books a year are being published, a lot of them self-published. Most self-published books sell less than 100 copies, the vast majority of them. But the fact that there's so many out there makes it maybe even harder to bring attention to your book, although I still do believe that the cream rises to the top.
I agree with most of that. I agree with all of it to a sense, but I don't always know if the cream is rising completely to the top. I guess it depends on what you mean by the top. I mean, there's a few people who are just killing it, and but very few. And there's a lot of really good people in the middle or upper middle. I think I'm probably in the upper middle. I've had some, obviously the books I write with Jim Patterson have been bestsellers. My last book, Look Closer, has done very, very well, but I'm still, wanting to, do better and find more readers. There's a big middle, and everyone's always looking for the next great writer. Being a first-time writer can be an advantage. If you do something really well in your first effort, you've got that promise of being the next great writer. And it's people who have a history who tend to struggle. I have a lot of friends who I started this business with who are no longer writing. There's an author named Walter Mosley, who you probably have met, a great writer, really smart guy, really interesting guy to spend time with. I don't pretend like we're close friends. I've only spoken with him a few times, but he spoke at a convention when I was just starting out in the early 2000s. And at that convention, at that panel, he said that the average lifespan of a writer at most is 10 years. Doesn't mean you can't be an exception, but that's the average. And he said, and a lot of people don't even make it for 10 years. I've been doing this for over 25 now. I feel very lucky. But it's hard. And you're right, it's saturated. The market is saturated now, and everyone's looking for something fresh. And it's hard to get fresh. It's hard to be fresh, to do something completely new, when everything is being done right now.
Now, David, you said when you wrote your first novel, you wrote 1 hour every night. What's your writing process look like now?
So now I've got a full-time job, right? I'm a judge on the appellate court in Illinois. So what I do is I get up at 3:30 in the morning and I write till 7.
Whoa, that's
Yeah, and
dedication.
well, that's a time when nobody is asking anything of me. There's very few distractions. There's very few, almost no text messages or emails. And so and not a lot of news shooting through, not a lot of breaking news popping onto your computer because everything pops onto your computer now. So, my children get up around 6:30 or 7. Same with my wife. So, sometimes I don't make it to 7. Sometimes it stops at 6:30, and sometimes I don't get up at 3:30. It's more like 4:15, and I'm disappointed when that happens. I'm usually grumpy when that happens. But the good news for me, Monica, is that I love it. And so the analogy I always make is when I have to wake up my daughter for school, even if she's had 12 hours of sleep, she doesn't want to get out of bed at 7 a.m. or what have you. But if I woke her up at 3 in the morning, but the reason was to get on an airplane and fly to Disney World, she'd pop out of bed. And so, the reason you're getting up has a lot to do with it. And I kind of feel like I'm going to Disney World every morning. I mean, I love that time of day, just me and maybe some music in my headphones, a cup of coffee, and I just get to play make believe.
Wow.
If I
So,
didn't love it, I couldn't do it.
yeah, obviously. So, let's talk a little bit about the best lies, which I gotta say, I don't know when I've last read a book that had so many twists and turns in it, and all of which made sense. There weren't any that like, okay, that's not realistic. They all made sense and worked. So when you started writing this, did you know what all those twists and turns were going to be?
No, I never do.
Wow.
I knew what the final twist was. That was one of the animating plot points of the book, was the final twist. And that's not uncommon for writers to think of what the big surprise is going to be. I knew that I wanted twists throughout the book, but I wasn't entirely sure what they were going to be. I will tell you that I wish I could do that, Monica, because if I could outline the entire book before I started, I could write a lot faster. I write with some ideas of what I want to do, and then usually as I get into it, the plot twists come to me. And sometimes they'll come to me and it will require me to go back and change some of the stuff I've already done. And so that's very inefficient, right? I could be on page 200 and say, hey, wait a second, I'm going to do this instead. And that may mean I have to go back pages 1 through 199 and make a bunch of changes and take 2 weeks just to do that. So I wish I didn't have to do that, but that's how I seem to do it. It's very important to me, and maybe James Patterson has just instilled this in me, but I want to surprise you at the end. Every one of these kinds of books is going to surprise you at the end if they're doing their job. But what I really want to do is I want to make the ride just as fun. And so, what I've started to do, I took a little bit of time where I wasn't writing my own books. I was being a judge and I was writing with Patterson. I took a break from my own books, which is a whole story itself. But when I started back up writing my own novels, which I just did during COVID in 2020 with Look Closer, followed up by Now the Best Lies, I thought, what I want to write what I like to read and what I like to watch. And what I really like watching on TV now is these one season episodic, Disney thrillers, where at the end of every episode, there's some either revelation or big twist that keeps you wanting to, go to the next one. And I have found that as without realizing I was doing it, I was basically writing like a one season episodic story with about 8 episodes. And at the end of every maybe 10,000 words, I want there to be a twist that you say, wait a second, what? And, to me, that's the most fun to read, and that's kind of what I've committed to doing now. It's hard to do that, but if you can pull it off, and it sometimes takes a long time, but it's rewarding.
So you in the big the best lies, sorry, I was thinking Big Little Lies or something like that. But anyway, the best lies, you use unreliable narrators. And is that, do you think, is there any way to do this constant twisting if you don't have the unreliable narrator?
I think so. I have yet to do that, but I think so. The next book I'm working on, I really have two points of view, and one of them I think is not going to be unreliable. You can have things unfold around you, even though you're a truth teller as the narrator. Sure, you could do that. What I tend to do with my books is I tend to invest the character and the protagonists into the plot. Their own backgrounds and their own lives become part of the plot. And so that's what makes it harder for me to, be too truthful with my protagonists because they have a lot of things going on in their lives. And maybe an unreliable protagonist will just be somebody with a secret in their background that they don't share with the reader right away. Which is
Right.
that unreliable, or are they just not mentioning to you yet? Sometimes even those definitions are hard to
Well,
pinpoint. It
that's a
doesn't.
good point because, well, let's talk about here in the best slides. You've got Leo and Andy. Would you call either of them unreliable or simply not revealing?
Yeah, I mean, right. This is kind of a definitional thing. Andy is Andrea, it's a woman. She goes by Andy. She's, I don't, I don't think she's unreliable. I think we just slowly reveal her character through things that have happened to her in the past. And she's not a first person character. She's told through the third person. That's a whole other story if you want to talk about that.
Yeah, I do actually.
But Leo is the first person. Protagonist. He's the only first person protagonist in the book. And it's a little hard to hide things from the reader for a while and then reveal them without the protagonist appearing to be a little bit unreliable. So if that's what we mean by unreliable, and I think that's what we mean, then yeah, he probably is unreliable. I mean, he's a pathological liar. He is a diagnosed pathological liar. And that was by choice. That was the very first decision I made for the entire book was who was Leo going to be? And because I've now learned that starting with a character is my formula for success. There's that old question, what's more important, the characters or the plot? And I used to think that was a false dichotomy that they're both equally important. And I still think they're both really important, but I give a slight nod now to character. I think if you care about the characters, well, let me say that statement in the negative. If you don't care that much about the characters, if you don't find them interesting to spend time with, maybe you don't like them. They don't have to be likable, but if they're not at least entertaining, like I can't wait to hear more about what's going on with Leo. If you don't feel that way, then the plot is probably going to suffer a little bit. So I start with character, and the very first decision I made was I'm going to write a book about a pathological liar. And that's going to immediately, and I don't hide that fact. I think we say that in the first chapter of the book. I want the reader to know that. I want the reader to be wondering about Leo throughout the book.
So you have Leo, and Leo's chapters are written in first person. So you have two points of view in the book. You have Leo and you have Andy, correct?
I actually have three points of view,
Three.
if you remember that the FBI agent is a third
Oh,
viewpoint.
right.
Yeah,
Yes. Yeah.
Chris Roberti.
Yeah. So you have three points of view. So one of them is first person, and two of them are third person. So
Why?
why and how does that work?
Okay, well, I will start by saying that I have a strong preference for first person narrative. I tend to write in a conversational tone, and I think that lends itself to first person narrative. I also think the first person narrative is more intimate. And I like to write intimate books. And by that, I think you probably know what I mean because you've read the book. I don't mean sexually intimate. I mean, I want you to be living inside these characters and feeling what they're feeling and smelling what they're smelling and thinking what they're thinking. And so first person is my favorite way to write. As I'm sure you know, Monica, you make so many decisions as an author, and that's one of them. Is every POV going to be in the same, first person? Are you going to do third person? I initially wrote Andy in the first person. One of the things that went into the decision not to do her in the first person is that Andy is a biracial woman, and I am not. I am a white man, and there was some concern that people might take that the wrong way. That, it's not that a white male author can't write a book about a biracial woman, but when you put it into the first person, it feels like you're maybe misappropriating or something. That was a real question that came up, and obviously, I don't hide who I am. My picture's on the back cover. I think enough people know who I am. I certainly wasn't pretending to be a biracial woman, but nevertheless, there were questions about sensitivity, and I'll be honest with you, we thought long and hard about it because I really loved Andy in the first person. And at the end of the day, I decided, if even one person is going to be distracted by that and offended by that, then I've lost that reader, and I don't want that to happen. It's not important enough to me. And given that I'd written almost the entire book already with her in the first person,
Wow.
changing the first person to the third person is probably more effective than doing it in the third person all along. That may
Really?
sound funny. Yeah,
Yeah.
I mean, I believe me, I didn't know this either. I've never done this before. Like I said, I feel like I climb into the characters better in the first person. I feel like I feel like you do. You inhabit the characters more in the first person. I wrote her in the first person and then changed it all to third, but didn't change too much else. You have to change a little bit, but
Yeah.
mostly it's just changing all the, pronouns and those kind of things. Mostly. And I was pretty happy with it when it was done. I thought, it's still a pretty personal portrayal of Andy. And I didn't do it lightly, by the way. I mean, I have some friends who are biracial, and I have some men, some women who are biracial who are roughly my age, who grew up around where I grew up in Chicago, which is where Andy grew up. And it was a challenge, and it was a unique challenge. It's everybody's life is unique, and growing up black in a predominantly white neighborhood is difficult. And I came to learn from interviewing these people and doing research and reading articles and people writing testimonials that growing up biracial is its own challenge, that in some ways people who grew up biracial were rejected by both
Both,
black and white people.
yeah.
And I thought that was fascinating, and I thought that would be a really interesting aspect of Andy's life, and I thought it would just make her a fuller character. So I didn't shy away from the topic. I actually embraced it. I thought it was a really cool idea. But then we sort of hit this road bump and said, are we going to piss people off if we do it in the first person? Are you acting like you know too much or something? And it's a real subtle thing. And I thought, well, I'm repeating myself now. If there's a chance that anyone would be bothered by this, then I don't want to do it. I want to be very respectful. And so, but it's something that writers have to do these days and think about more than they ever have had to before.
Right,
It's
which is not a
probably a
bad
good
thing.
thing. No, it's
Yeah.
probably a good thing in the main, but it creates challenges. I read a book by Don Winslow, who's an exceptional writer. I don't know if you've met Don, you probably have. I actually have not met him, but he wrote a book called The Force, and it was about a little elite but very corrupt group of cops in New York City. And the main character, three of the four characters were white and one was black. And they were these hardened New York City police detectives who were corrupt. And you read the N-word on every page, every single page. Don Winslow's a white man. And he was being authentic to those characters. And I understand that he did a lot of research, but that was a gutsy thing to do. because you run a risk that someone will say, well, you can't use words like that. And I'm very sensitive to that. I mean, I would certainly never use that word other than if I were writing it in a book, and I would never even write it in a book. Like, I wouldn't even think of doing that. I would find a way to get around that. But he embraced it, and I think most people embraced that book, and nobody said, "Oh, you can't do that." But it's a really interesting thing that you have to deal with now. Being realistic, but not offended.
That's true. That's true. But it's good that we are actually taking the opinion of people whose opinion wasn't even considered for a long time into consideration now.
Oh, I think it's vital. I mean, I think it is. I certainly write differently. I have a daughter who's 14 and a daughter who's 17. I have a very strong, intelligent wife who's a brilliant. She's smarter than me. She's a brilliant woman. I know three very strong women in my life who I've learned so much from about the world and how it is to grow up in the world, not a white man. And I appreciate that, and I think that's all been baked into how I write characters now. But the fact remains, like, say for example, Monica, I wanted to write a book with a racist cop. Like, I don't actually have any plans to do that in the near future, but say I did, say one of my characters was racist. You know, I would have to think really hard about the dialogue and the thinking, and because if anyone dared attribute those thoughts to me as the author, then I would be offending people. If they could separate that and say, oh, no, this is just a character, well, then, then we'd be okay. But, you can't have a dialogue with every reader and say, this is what I'm doing here. Don't be offended. So it's a real, it's a real struggle that everyone deals with. My books, I don't really go into those areas much, so I don't really have to worry about it. But they're always in your mind when you're writing characters.
Now, the third character, Chris, the FBI agent, is also third person. And it's that mainly because he's not as important. You didn't don't really want to be as intimate in his head.
That was my thinking. I mean, the premise of this novel, basically, and this is not a spoiler because it comes out quite early, is, Leo Balanoff has two principal character traits. One is he's a diagnosed pathological liar, and the other is he's a crusading attorney who will stop at almost nothing to right a wrong in the criminal justice system, often to his great personal expense. And as the book begins, Leo finds himself charged with murder of a very, very bad person and ends up, to get out of that criminal charge, being roped into an undercover FBI investigation. And so Chris Roberti is the FBI agent. Chris was obviously important enough in the book that I needed his point of view. You know, he was going to see many things that Leo and Andy were not going to see, so I needed that point of view. But from a character development standpoint, he was probably slightly less important. The book is really about Leo and Andy, but these are all hard decisions to make. At one point, I had a fourth point of view, and then I changed it. My next book, I think I'm going to do two points of view, but I'm not sure. Let's see how it goes. I may find out I need a third, I mean, some of these things you try to decide at the outset and then you adjust.
Have you ever written a book that only had a single point of view?
Oh, yeah, many, most.
Most?
Most of my books, including my first one, the one, the Edgar Line of Vision, it was just one point of view throughout the book. It can be done. And that's a very personal experience with the narrator. If the entire book is through one person's eyes in the first person, that's about as intimate and personal as you get. And I would be more than happy to do that again. I think I'm kind of repeating myself. I don't start with a preconceived notion. I try to come up with some ideas at the beginning of how many POVs are going to be in the book, But yeah, if I could write an entire book from one POV, I would probably do it. That would probably be ideal.
Would you recommend for someone starting out writing this type of book that that might be an easier way to start is with a single point of view? Is it more complex to write a story with multiple points of view, I guess, is what I'm
No,
asking.
I think it's easier, Monica,
Okay.
because you know one of the I remember writing the first book, and I remember writing my second book, my third book, my fourth. I think I've done mostly single POVs, at least in the first several books. And I remember thinking, boy, wouldn't it be easier if I could bring another point of view? Because you know, if you've got one set of eyes, then all the information has to come to that person through.
Yeah.
Only to that person.
Yeah.
And if stuff's going on behind the scenes, I might want to wait till later in the book to reveal that through the protagonist, but I might want to tell the reader before I tell the protagonist.
Right.
The protagonist is going through life thinking A, B, and C, and the reader's like, oh, no, there's this XYZ out here that you don't know about yet. Can't wait to see how that plays out.
Yeah.
Oh, there were many times writing my first few books thinking, God, this would be easier if I had multiple POVs. But I really liked the one person POV. So
That's a tough choice to make.
it
Yeah,
is.
yeah.
And you can have too many of them too. These are all difficult decisions.
Yes, and one of the things that you did in this book at least is each chapter is a single point of view and it says at the top whose point of view you're in. So
Yes.
you're not going to get confused. The reader's not
Yeah,
going to get confused.
and that's a challenge, you
Yeah.
know, that's a challenge to not confuse people.
Right.
But yeah, I think that that also makes for a quicker paced book when you keep switching POVs like that with short chapters. It's a very punchy pace. This book is very fast paced. The chapters are short. I like to write short chapters. I think that was also imbued in me by Jim Patterson, who's very into short chapters. And I think his thinking was it forces you to pack a punch and not waste the reader's time. And you know, I don't have a set number of words per chapter, but I have a general idea that I don't want it to be very long. And the punchier the better. So it's I don't know. I think readers I've let me put it this way. I've never had a reader say to me, I wish you didn't have short chapters. They often will say though, I love the short chapters because it moves the pace so quickly. And so anything that will keep the pace up in a book like this is important because I want the reader to have fun. I
Right.
want them to keep reading. I want them to not want to put down the book. And long chapters are less likely to make you feel that way.
Yeah, because you get to the end of a short chapter and you think, oh, I'll just read one more chapter, it's short. And then you get to that, oh, I'll just read one more chapter, it's short. Whereas if the next chapter is long, it's like, oh, this is a good place to stop. So I think you're right that it does pull people on. You're listening to Writers' Voices today, and our guest is David Ellis, author of The Best Lives. So, David, a couple quick questions. You talked earlier about liking these episodic TV things. Have any of your books been turned into movies or TV series?
They haven't been turned into them yet, but we optioned The Best Lies actually before it was published to Warner Brothers Television. And they seem very excited. You never know in that business, so I don't count my chickens before they've hatched, but I felt like we really bonded and when we talked about what an episodic series would look like, they were the things that they said were exactly what I was thinking about the book. And so I really thought we hit it off, and I'm hopeful. The book before that was Look Closer, and that has been optioned as well.
Well, I have to admit that with The Best Lies, I'm like, surely you're going to write more about Leo and Andy. This isn't the end of their story. Or is
You know, I don't usually. There was one time in my career where I wrote a series of four books about the same protagonist. One of the things that keeps me from bringing back characters, if this makes sense, is their backgrounds are such a part of the plot. You know, where they came from and how, you know, Leo is a pathological liar. Why is he a pathological liar? Well, there's an answer if you go back into his life story. And we do, of course, go back into his life story, and it plays a part in the plot. And, you know, when that's how you like to write books, which seems to be what I like to do, I like to really get you inside these characters and then have them play out as part of the plot. I think that's an enjoyable experience for the reader. When you do that, it's kind of hard to bring them back because there's no more surprises. So, you know, Leo, he's a criminal defense attorney. Could I write a book where he defends somebody and tries to help them get out of a jam, and maybe, as he is wont to do, puts himself in a jam by trying to help that person? Sure, I could do that. And there are people asking me to do that. So, Leo's a very fun guy to spend time with, and I had fun spending time with him and creating him. So yeah, maybe, but again, you know so much about him if you've read The Best Lies that
Yeah,
I really
I could see that could be an issue for sure.
yeah. So but I'm open, Monica. You know, I'm always open to these ideas. And I think about them. When I wrote Look Closer, it's done very, very well. And people said, you got to bring these characters back. And I said, yeah, maybe, but nothing's jumping to mind right now. I feel like I've torn them all down and built them back up. And, you know, you want me to tear them down again? But I've got a lot of good characters to work with. I mean, the characters in The Best Lies, I think, would work very well being brought back. But I have not yet thought of how I would do that.
Okay. I did also want to ask you about the books you wrote with James Patterson. How did that come about, and why did you take this detour from writing your own books and then come back to it?
So when I wrote my very first book, Line of Vision, back in the late 90s, early 2000, you know, we did what anybody who's an unknown writer would do. We reached out to big time writers and asked them if they would review the book and say something nice. Jim was nice enough to read the book. He really liked it. He really, really liked it. And he gave me a very nice blurb, which is went right on to the paperback version. You know, I think he said it's the best suspense novel I've read in a long time or something. And it turned out when I went to New York, because back then in New York City, there were four mystery only bookstores. You know, that's how big bookstores were at the turn of the century, right? I feel so old saying the turn of the century, but really, like, that was Manhattan alone had four just mystery brick and mortar bookstores. They have, I think, one now. And every one of them I went to sign the books and to meet them, they said, oh, you know who was just here singing your praises was Jim Patterson. So I was lucky. You know, I'm right. I mean, I was sky high. I'm like, wow, he really liked my book. Fast forward about 8 years, 7 years, year 2007, I switched literary agents, and my new agent was a guy who had been the publisher at Warner Books. He ran Warner Books, which was an umbrella to a bunch of imprints like Little Brown, which was Patterson. So he was good friends with Jim Patterson. Anyway, he became a literary agent. He signed me, and that agent of mine at the time was then having lunch with Jim, as he does from time to time. And Jim asked him, who are your clients? You've left the publishing world. You're an agent now. Who'd you sign? He mentioned me, and Jim said, oh, I know Dave Ellis. He wrote Line of Vision, and started talking about it as if he'd read it yesterday, because that's how Jim's brain is. If he likes something, he could tell you all about it 20 years later. So, and tell you exactly like what you did right, maybe what you did wrong also. Like, but he would, you know, he. From a craft perspective, oh, he really set the character well. His, you know, the pacing was great, whatever. Anyways, by then Jim was starting to have co-authors, and so my agent and him were talking and said maybe Dave could be a co-author. So, to be honest with you, I was initially reluctant. I think I was intimidated by the prospect. I didn't want to screw it up, but you know, I called him. My agent said, call him and talk to him. If you have any qualms about it, call him and tell him what you're thinking. Work it out. So I called him and I said, Jim, I'm really honored that you would even consider me because you're the biggest author in the world. but I don't think I know how to write a James Patterson book. And he said, I'm not hiring you to write a James Patterson book. I want us to write a James Patterson, David Ellis book. I want you to bring your skill set and I'll bring mine. And I know how you write. I know what I can do with you. And let's work together and do some really cool stuff. And I thought, wow, that's about the greatest thing the guy could have said to me. You know? And he's always treated it like a collaboration, like working with Jim. You know, if there's a boss, then he's the boss, but he never acts like that. He just talks to me about, you know, and usually he'll outline the entire book before it starts. He'll
okay.
have every scene in mind. That's how he does it. I told you earlier, I cannot do that. He can.
Okay.
He will plot the entire book out, chapter 1 to chapter 90, bunch of short scenes, right?
Okay.
Or chapter 95, whatever. And then I'll write it a little bit at a time and give it to him, and he'll tell me what he thinks. And if it's great, he'll say, great, keep going. If it's not, he'll say, let's do this. Let's change this. I thought this chapter was a little slow. I want to punch this up. And he reserves the right to put his hands on it at any time and do it himself. That doesn't happen very often. Although in the current book we're writing together, he did that in one of the chapters. He asked me to rewrite it a couple of times and said, let me just take a shot. And then he wrote it the way he wanted. And I said, okay, I see what you wanted. Fine. This is going to sound funny because he's like the, you know, best-selling author in the world, but he has no ego about it. You know, he has no pride of authorship. He's all about, we want to write a really good story. And, you know, sometimes I'll come up with an idea that's different from the outline because I told you that's what happens with me, right?
Right, I think of something, right, yeah.
On page 200. And I'll call him and I'll say, hey, how about this instead? And he'll say, all right, yeah, sure, give that a shot. And if it doesn't work, go back to the outline. But sure, give it a shot and let's see where it goes. He doesn't care if it was my idea or his. He just wants it to be really cool and fresh and interesting. And so, you know, so I talk to him, you know, every couple of weeks when we, you know, go over pages. And I feel like every one of them is a masterclass because the guy knows so much about writing. He'll be the first one to say, we are not writing Pulitzer Prize winning novels. He's not trying to.
Right.
He probably
right.
could if he wanted to, but he doesn't want to. That's not his goal. He knows what he is. He knows what his readers expect. And that's very important to him. And so he'll always say, we're not trying to win writing awards. We're trying to tell good stories. And I'll always know he's about to give me some critical feedback when he'll say, okay, let's look at chapter, you know, whatever, 17, Dave. He'll say, well, this was really well written. There's always going to be a but. After it was really well written, but it was a little long, you know, a little too much description of the room. We know, give us some flavor, but you don't need to beat us over the head. And let's pick this part up more, you know. You know, he says, of course he wants it to be well written. Of course he does.
Yeah,
but everybody
yeah.
wants to write well. And I think he appreciates that I, for the most part, at least, write pretty well. But if I'm not keeping the promise with the reader, he's going to tell me. Like, he's very nice, but he will not compromise. Like, if it's not good enough, he'll say, this is not good enough yet. He'll say it nicely, but he'll say it.
Now, why does he do this, do you think? Why is he working with, and are you the only writer? Does he just do one work with one other author at a time, or does he have multiple books going with multiple authors? And why do that?
He's got multiple books.
Yeah.
Going and say he'll sometimes write his own books too, but he's got multiple authors over multiple genres. You know what I think excites him the most at this stage in his career is the conceptualizing. You know, mm-hmm. hey, here's an idea. Wouldn't this be cool? Let me plot out a little story here. You know, I don't know how to analogize it to a movie, but. You know, it's like having an idea and saying, you know, maybe I won't write the screenplay, but I'm going to come up with the idea. And this is what it's going to be about. And wouldn't this be cool if this happened? What about this? And he likes that. And he likes sort of saying, let's basically set an outline that he knows I'm not going to stick to completely. And he doesn't care as long as it's good. That's all he cares about is it's good. So sometimes, yeah, I'll stray from his outline, and sometimes he'll get mad about it. He'll get frustrated. He won't say he's mad, but I know him well enough now. And he'll say, let's go back. Let's, you know, he'll say, Dave, we're getting a little off course here. Fine. You know, that's fine. It's his call ultimately, but I think he likes that. I think he's an idea guy, and I think he enjoys the craft of writing, but I think he likes the idea of crafting it and then seeing it written, but you know, and molding it and shaping it and critiquing it and getting it where he wants without him having to do it all himself. I mean, look, the ideas are the most fun part, right? If I had his level of success and I could do what he does, I probably would do the same thing because that's really fun. And I mean, look, writing can be plotting sometimes. It can be teeth gnashing, pulling your hair out. You know, I don't know how to say what I'm trying to say. I don't know what to write back. It can be really frustrating.
Yeah.
And I think he is just having the time of his life doing what he's doing.
Great. Well, David, I also want to get into sort of how your work as a lawyer and as a judge informs your writing. But before we run out of time, could you read a section from The Best Lies for us?
I can. I usually think that it's best to start at the beginning because it's a pretty good start to the book and gives you an idea of what's going on. There is some dialogue. I'll try to change my voice inflection.
Okay.
So this is from the standpoint of Leo, beginning of the book. I hear them coming up the back stairs, the fire escape off the alley. Their footfalls are harsh, trudging, deliberate. So they're not coming to kill me. That's the good news. The bad news is they're coming to arrest me. You should reconsider your life choices when those are the only two possibilities. Cops, local or federal, I'm not sure which I should fear more. I'll know soon. I pull out my phone and dial my law partner, Montgomery Morris. Happy Valentine's Day, he says. You busy? I'm on my way to the Bulls game. Why? I'm going to need a lawyer, Monty. You what? Why? It's a long story. They're about to take me into custody. Well, when? In about 11 seconds, I say. 11 seconds? The Bulls are playing Giannis tonight. Is it serious? Probably. It depends on which crime they charge. There's more than one to choose from? It depends on whether it's FBI or local cops. You don't even know that much? What did you do now, Leo? By the way, tell me when you want me to stop.
Okay.
The fire escape from the second story to the third, where I live, is 14 stairs. 7 stairs, then a landing, then another 7. You'd think that would mean that, combined with the flight from the ground to the second floor, the total number of stairs is 28. But it's 29, as there's an extra step on the bottom. And 29 is not only a prime number, but the sum of 3 consecutive squares, 2, 3, and 4, which helps me not at all right now, but yeah. 2 people appear at my back door. One is a guy I don't recognize. The other is Mary Cagnola, a sergeant with Demer Park Police Department, both with their badges out so I can see them. Demer Park PD, I tell Monty and punch out the phone before he can object. I slide open the door, a shock of cold air invading my condo. Leo Balanoff, Sergeant Cagnola, does the talking. If I were cool, I'd say something like, "What took you so long?" And here I didn't get a Valentine for you guys, I say. No Valentines, Leo. We have a warrant for your arrest for the murder of Cyrus Balick.
That's a good place to stop, I think. Yeah.
That's okay. How the book begins. Your cops come up the back stairs and they arrest him, and we know immediately he's getting into some jam.
And that reminds me of another question I wanted to ask, which was one of Leo's sort of traits is this fascination with numbers, particularly prime numbers.
Yes.
Where did that come from? Is that, you know, someone like that or what?
Yeah. So that's I'll try to keep this short. It's a multi-pronged answer, I think. But you're right. I mean, Leo is fixated on numbers and they run through his head all the time when he's talking. And he likes to share them with the reader once in a while, like that stupid thing where he's counting the stairs on the staircase. It's not stupid, but it's annoying to him. You know, part of the reason is that, I get fixated on numbers. There are a lot of things that, a lot of numbers that I fixate on, and I play numbers games in my head. I've always done that. And I think it's kind of entertaining if you do it right in an entertaining way, which I certainly try to do, which is actually reason number two. You know, I want the reader's experience with Leo at all times to be fun. I mean, that's my goal, is fun. And so there are obviously, no matter how you try to avoid it, going to be some slower moments in the book. And sometimes I can make some of those plot points a little bit more enjoyable if we have Leo going a little crazy with numbers in his head. Again, it's a delicate balance. You don't want to overdo it, but he plays some games that I think people will probably enjoy. I hope so. But also, you know, on a more serious level, Monica, there is a plot reason why he's like that, which I won't give away, but he talks about it a little bit. Given his background and his life, there is a reason why numbers are of such comfort to him.
Right, right.
So it kind of works on a lot of levels for me.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I also, you know, I think in numbers a lot. I think in words too, but I also, I count everything all the time.
Yeah.
And when I look at I'm in business and my background's accounting, and I will look at, someone sends me a report, someone sends me information, and I can find the error in the numbers, like, without even trying. It just pops out at me. And, you know, so it's funny how people's brains work differently. And it took me a long time to realize not everybody's like that.
No, people aren't. And I don't know. I think it's for me, I've got a lot of little weird things I do with numbers. And my wife, I think she's just trying to comfort me. I always say it's a sign of some neuroses. She always says it's a sign of a brilliant mind. And I said, I don't know about that. But when I was a young kid, by that I mean, I think second grade, some teacher told me that you could tell whether a number is divisible by three by counting the digits of the number. And if the sum of the digits is divisible by three, then the number is divisible by three.
I never knew that.
Right. So 213 is 2 plus 1 plus 3 is 6. It's divisible by 3. And ever since they told me that, as I would sit in the back of my parents' car, I would see numbers on a license plate, and I would determine like that whether they were divisible by 3 or not. I still do that today. I just had a long driving trip that we did, and every license plate I saw, I would skip the letters, look at the numbers, and I would determine whether they're divisible by 3 or not. Without even, it's just automatic. So something needs to occupy that part of my brain, apparently. I know it's odd. It doesn't really bother me. It doesn't torment me. Leo's a little tormented by his number fascination, but Leo's got a different reason for it than
I do. Right. Okay, so we are almost out of time. So quick question. Do your kids read your books?
You know, my kids are just too young to read my books. It's not that they otherwise wouldn't. 12 and 14 is too young for these books. My 17-year-old read Look Closer, and she'll probably read The Best Lies. 17's old enough these days.
Yeah.
There's nothing a 17-year-old hasn't seen.
Right. And how did she respond to Look Closer?
I mean, she seemed to like it quite a bit. She would reach out to me. She actually goes to she's in high school, but she's a violinist, and she goes to a boarding school for the arts. Mm. She actually is a high schooler who lives not at home, which in the Midwest is unusual. I know on the East Coast it's normal.
Yeah.
But so she's in Michigan during the school year, and she was texting me little comments about the book, and she's pulling little pieces of me out of the book. She's like, that sounds like you so much. And she knows me, of course. She's known me her whole life.
Yeah.
So it's fun. It's a little nerve wracking, but it's mostly just fun to share that. And, you know, someday I assume my kids will read some of my books. My 14-year-old, I think there's a chance she'll become a writer herself. Uh-huh. I know she'll read them.
That's fantastic.
She's a terrific writer. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Well, David, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I really love this book. I couldn't put it down, that's for sure.
Well,
and we always close with the quote. And I feel like, you know, there's an underlying theme here of justice.
Yes.
And so I picked a quote from Theodore Roosevelt. Justice consists not in being neutral between right and wrong, but in finding out the right and upholding it wherever found against the wrong.
Well, that is exactly what Leo would say.
Yes.
That exactly describes Leo. He will at all costs try to achieve justice.
Right.
Yeah, well, that's great. I love that. I'll try to remember that.
All right. Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you, Monica.